greetings and welcome to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the struggles of African people towards victory and independence in our lifetime. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and here on the forum, we'll examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. We'll bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean Theater of the Mind, and of course, musical interludes. Well, violence and protests continue to mar countries in North and West Africa, as in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, forces loyal to incumbent leader Laurent Gbagbo retook the state television headquarters this morning. Gunfire erupted again just blocks from the presidential palace. I spoke with a very close friend of mine yesterday, and he described the tension that exists in that country. Rebels loyal to internationally recognized President Alassane Ouattara made a lightning advance through the country. Officials claim that about 800 people have been killed since the elections were held last November, but there is growing speculation that that figure is vastly undercounted. Gbagbo, who has not been seen in public since the offense began, he promises to fight until the end. At least 1 million people have fled Abidjan. Since the devastating earthquake in Haiti last year and the even more devastating one in Japan, which caused that tsunami, killing thousands and leaving millions homeless, many nations have stepped up their preparation mode for any eventuality. The Caribbean, which is vulnerable for complete obliteration should a tsunami hit the region, has been preparing for such an event. Joining me this morning will be Dr. Lorna Innes. She's the Deputy Director of the Coastal Zone Management Unit in Barbados. Later in the program, joining us from St. Lucia will be journalist Jerry George, as that nation prepares for its general elections later on this year. And during our second hour, Heartbeat Communication CEO, Ms. Felicia Posad, she will be bringing us up to date with the news affecting the Caribbean nationals across the diaspora. So stay tuned for the next 2 hours here on Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple. Heard Saturday mornings from 9 until 11 Eastern Standard Time. We'll be back with our special guest, Dr. Lorna Innes. Here is Red Plastic Bag, talking about Barbados, known as Bim.
Bim, I love you. Bim, I am proud of you. Many left your shores to live in big city, but that's not the case with me. Some call you bad and cry you dumb. Certainly not me. Of the soil I am a true son. I know my children may not reach prestigious high school, but for the big boy zone to go, it has become a rule. And when they grow up, they may hardly find a job, and in broad daylight they may be raped or robbed. And if we can find someone after searching through this well, no problem at all, we can find them dead in a cell. I know that them foreigners really taking over slowly. They start with one street in the city, but even if them Yankees bring in cadavers to frighten me, they can't move me. I ain't leaving this country.
I ain't going nowhere. It's here I intend to stay. If it rise or fall, I ain't leaving this land at all. Proud of you.
I'll do my part as a true citizen and be loyal to the island. I'll stick to my roots for as long as I live, and day by day is my best I intend to give. I know I may be beaten badly by the law, and I may not even be the one that they're looking for. And some conductors really know a lot of tricks. Just one plastic bag can put money in your pocket. I know administration stinks at the transport board. The government polices take government buses off the road. We can get to Coney Islands to put on the same spot. More madmen are out than you can find them here in Black Rock. But even if one beat me bad, like how one be sleepy, that can't move me. I ain't leaving this country.
I ain't going nowhere. It's here I intend to stay. And if it rise or fall, I ain't leaving this land at all.
Is proud of you throughout the Caribbean. Know how you played your part. Bim, you hold a special place in my heart. Then why should I run away and roam when it's right here that is my sweet little home? If I am a Kaisonian, I must abstain from politics. I must not even cry out when they're cutting my tail with licks. And if I am a teacher, they may suspend me wrongfully. But at school I can drink the whiskey once I remove the label, you see. If I want to get rich quickly, I only have to become MP. But as a hawker or fisherman, they may try to mama guy me. 1% of my salary, they take and call it transport levy. And if I decide to drive taxi, I may be called dirty. But even if housing can weigh my furniture's wrongfully, they can't move me. I ain't leaving this country.
I ain't going nowhere. It's here I intend to stay. And if it rise or fall, I ain't leaving this land at all.
Yes, that is Stetson Wilshire, better known as Red Plastic Bag, singing about Bim. Bim, better known as Barbados. And underlying joining us this morning is the Deputy Director of the Coastal Zone Management Unit in Barbados, Dr. Lorna Innes. Good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good to be here.
Well, absolutely.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure having you on the air with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm sure you're basking in that sunny weather there in Barbados, aren't you?
It's wonderful. I went running this morning. The sun is beautiful. The sky is perfectly blue.
Okay. Now, Mr. Innes, Dr. Innes, please don't rub it in. Dr. Innes, for the past 10 years, you have been the Deputy Director of the Coastal Zone Management Unit in Barbados. What is the primary function of the Coastal Zone Unit?
The unit is a government agency under the Ministry of Environment, Water Resources, and Drainage. And our jurisdiction is the coastal area that extends to the 200-meter depth contour offshore. And inshore, our jurisdiction ends at the seaward boundary of the coastal road, or where there is no coastal road, we go right into the 1 in 100 year floodplain. And what we do in that particular coastal zone management area, as we call it, we regulate coastal development. We do shoreline stabilization. As you know, because of Barbados' the principal industry of Barbados is tourism. We spend a lot of time ensuring that our beaches remain healthy and as natural as possible, but where the natural beach has been eroded, we do coastal engineering works to support the beach and to keep it in place. We also manage and monitor the coastal ecosystems in that coastal zone management area, which would be the coral reefs, the seagrass beds, what mangrove swamps we have left in Barbados, which are not very many at all. And we also try to protect the sand dunes. And then through the entire planning process, we try to make sure that windows to the sea remain where they are, and we try to ensure that on every coast there is adequate coastal accesses for the public.
In 1867, and that is, some 144 years ago?
That's right.
A 7.3 magnitude earthquake occurred in the basin that generated a tsunami with wave heights near 7.7 meters, which is approximately 25 feet in St. Croix and around the Guadeloupe area. Because of an apparent pattern of large earthquakes around the world, would you say that the Caribbean region should be concerned that another quote-unquote big one could be imminent?
Absolutely. The pattern is showing very clearly that we seem to be in an elevated period of seismic activity. That's the first. But also, history has shown us that the Caribbean is overdue for a mega earthquake event. In history, we have gotten these events on average every 100, 120 years. And now we've gone past the 120 years since we've had a mega event. And so the experts in seismology, particularly Dr. Joan Latchman from the Seismic Research Center in Trinidad and Tobago, she has advised the Caribbean countries that we are overdue. And she says quite clearly, it is not if it will come, it is when. And she cannot give us a date and a time, but it will come. So we have been trying to prepare, both here in Barbados and across the region, prepare countries not just for the earthquake, but also for the possibility of a tsunami being generated from the earthquake.
Currently, what agency or agencies provide tsunami warning services to the Caribbean region?
Currently, we receive warnings from the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii. The reason for that is because it was after the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami that the international community mobilized the division of UNESCO that deals with oceans to begin developing these regional early warning systems. Now, the Caribbean had a proposal, but basically was starting from scratch in terms of developing its monitoring and detection systems, both for earthquake and tsunami, and both onshore as well as offshore. That process has taken the last 5 years, and we are still not at 100% in terms of installation of instruments, but we have a number of instruments now across the region for detecting earthquakes. We're close to 90% now installation in terms of seismic stations. Most of the islands have at least one seismic station for detecting earthquakes in real time. We want to make sure that data gets to the warning center in the Pacific,
right,
via satellite immediately. And then we want to know immediately if an earthquake has occurred, we want to know immediately if a tsunami has been generated. So we look at the sea level network. Now, the sea level network in the Caribbean has been developing much more slowly than the seismic network. And we are trying to make sure that we have funding, trying to encourage countries to purchase sea level gauges to ensure that the network is developed as quickly as possible. I would say at the moment we are about 35%. We have about 35% of the sea level instruments that we're supposed to have. So you can imagine that is quite low, especially after 5 years.
Absolutely. Just over a week ago on March 23rd, a Caribbean tsunami warning exercise was conducted there in Barbados. What were some of the main objectives of that exercise?
Well, let me just tell you first that it was not just in Barbados.
Okay.
The Caribbean, the wider Caribbean region tsunami and coastal hazards warning system held the exercise, and that's 33 countries. All of the countries that border the Caribbean Sea participated in the exercise.
Okay.
And each country decided on its own what level of exercise it would implement.
Approximately how many of those countries were represented in that exercise?
We had about 29 so far reported in that they participated.
Okay.
We're still, of course, getting reports. So we're actually hoping, we know for sure that Canada did not participate. And of course, Canada really is a part of the Pacific system and not really the Caribbean system. However, they had the option of participating in the exercise. We haven't heard from Cuba yet, but we know that Cuba has excellent disaster management systems.
Okay.
And we were actually hoping that they would participate. Colombia has reported in, Ecuador, Anguilla, even the Dutch Antilles, the French Antilles, everyone did some level of exercise. There were some countries that didn't have their communications protocols in place for tsunami as yet. For example, you want to designate officially a single agency and the head of that agency to receive the tsunami warning on your country's behalf.
Okay.
And in Barbados, that is the director of the Met Service. And most of the countries, in fact, it's the director of the Met Service. And so what they do, they receive the warnings from the warning center in real time. I'll give you an example. In the Haiti event last January, we received the warning less than 5 minutes after that earthquake occurred. And then as soon as I saw on my on my cell phone that a 7.3 earthquake had occurred in Haiti, I knew that Barbados had to be on alert. And therefore, I immediately activated our national emergency management system just in case. Even though the message said that only the warning for tsunami was only in effect for Cuba, Bahamas, Dominican Republic, and Haiti. And for the other countries of the Caribbean, it was an information statement only. But the information statement, that means that you still had to be cautious. You still had to keep listening to make sure that the waves were not coming out further down than they anticipated.
If you've just joined us, you tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We're chatting with Dr. Lorna Innes. She is the deputy director of the Coastal Zone Management Unit in Barbados, and she's also chair of the Natural Sciences Committee of the UNESCO National Commission and the Standing Committee on Coastal Hazards. If you'd like to join us in discourse, you can call us within the United States, area code 727-565-1599. That's 727-565-1599. Or you can Skype us. Our ID is Uhuru Radio, UHURU Radio. Or if you're calling us from across the pond in the United Kingdom, you can call us at 440-20-8133-6629. Dr. Innes, what are some of the obstacles, if any, that were presented during the exercise based on the reports that you have already received from other Caribbean nations?
Some of the obstacles are that the official system, communication system for receiving tsunami warnings is the World Meteorological Organization's global telecommunication system. And there were some countries that reported that they didn't receive the warning via the official system.
Mm.
We realized that there were glitches in the GTS, as we call it, that need to be solved. Particularly the French Antilles noted that they did not receive the warnings. However, most of the others have, and of course the French as well, would have some level of redundancy in their system in order to receive the warning. So, for example, Barbados received the warning via the GPS. That's in the Met Service. I, myself and the Director of the Emergency Services, We received the warning on our cell phones. We also received faxes and emails from the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center. What in the U.S. where you are, and in fact many of the Caribbean countries, the emergency management departments also have the Emergency Managers Weather Information Network that also receives tsunami warnings. So you want to make sure that you get that warning by as many different channels as possible. Another obstacle then that was identified was that many countries had not yet identified how they were going to get that warning from their national person who received it to the most vulnerable person on the beach.
Which could be critical.
Exactly. You've got to be able to move that warning through your population via a number of different communications channels as well. And countries are still developing these. So, for example, British Virgin Islands, we know that they have, or I should say they're called Virgin Islands now, I think, they have sirens on the beaches.
Mm.
And they could activate the sirens. There are some countries that don't like the sirens and are considering using church bells. They're considering using even small cannons. They're considering using SMS messaging. However, you know that in an emergency, usually the cell phones jam. And that is one of the obstacles that was identified as well.
Yes, but Dr. Ennis, sorry, I'm sorry to cut you, but those church bells would have to be manually operated.
Very true, very true. And that is one of the challenges with church bells. Not only that, you use church bells to call people to church. So how do they know that you're telling them there's a tsunami coming? That's one of my problems with people using the church bells. When you decide you're going to use a particular channel to warn the population, it needs to be very clear. You are saying to them there is an emergency, you need to act now. And I don't think the church bells will do that.
Has the commission ensured that other Caribbean islands do have up-to-date equipment, even state-of-the-art equipment? Because, you know, you're talking about the difference between life and death.
It's true. At the intergovernmental sessions, we discuss these things. However, you would appreciate that each state is sovereign and has the sovereign right to decide how to warn its own citizens.
That's correct.
And therefore, the intergovernmental group itself cannot dictate to any country how they would warn their citizens. We can only recommend.
Right.
And that's what we've been doing. We give them all of the options. We even do training nationally in the different countries. If a country requests help with developing their communication systems, then we would send in experts and say, okay, we would recommend that you use this and this and this. Of course, there are some countries that have weather radio. They have radio interrupt. For example, we are right here on a radio show. If there's an emergency now where you are, it is possible that you could get an interruption of this program.
Absolutely.
To say there is a tsunami occurring wherever you are, and people need to move. We want to be able to have TV interrupt as well. We want to have streaming messages along the bottom of TV screens in hotel rooms, because as you know, all our tourism is coastal. So we have tourists who are in harm's way as well. But also, one of the big recommendations coming out of the exercise last week is that countries need to officially, legally adopt building codes so that where vertical evacuation is required, because you cannot find a hill to run up away from the tsunami, you need to be able to go up to the top floor or up to the roof of coastal buildings. But you need to be sure that the buildings themselves are strong enough.
What agency is responsible for ensuring that that is done?
In Barbados, it's the Barbados Building Standards Authority, and they have been working to ensure. We have a draft building code now. It is just now for the policymakers to take that and to enact it. But we would like now to actually review that draft building code in the context of tsunamis. Because at the moment, I'm aware that the building code has nothing in it that says coastal hotels, for example, should keep the ground floor completely open, maybe for parking, so that if there are waves that come into the hotel, you don't surprise people in their bed sleeping, you might lose a few cars, but you won't lose any lives. And that's the whole point, objective of this.
The Caribbean Tsunami Warning Center is proposed to be established in Puerto Rico by 2014. Because of the change in weather patterns that we have been experiencing globally, do you feel, Dr. Ennis, that these warning centers should have already been in place?
Absolutely. The last major tsunami in the Caribbean where lives were lost was in 1946, which is not so long ago.
No, it's not.
There was also one in Puerto Rico in 1918 where a number of people died again. And one would have expected that by now we would have had a regional warning system. The problem is there was perhaps a reluctance on the part of governments, regional governments, to move on this issue because you're dealing with a hazard that is frequent. We deal with hurricanes and tropical storms every year. Mm-hmm. So our Met offices and the U.S. National Hurricane Center, which is the regional center of excellence for hurricanes and tropical storms, has that system very, very well in hand.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of tsunamis, the hazard, you know, you could put up a warning center in place and then not have a tsunami for 100 years in a particular region.
Absolutely.
So the governments were reluctant to allocate resources in the face of such an event, but now they're seeing them, of course, with more frequency than usual.
How soon?
Now they're mobilized to actually allocate resources.
How soon will Barbados have its center in place?
Well, there will be just one regional center to service all 33 countries.
Okay, I got you.
So that one in Puerto Rico is proposed to be the Caribbean Tsunami Warning Center for all 33 countries of the region. And we will all receive our tsunami alerts from there, the same way that we are receiving them now from the Pacific. As you could imagine, the resources requirements for setting up such a center are significant. And that's the reason why you develop a warning system on a regional basis first and not a national basis.
How will this project be?
It's just so expensive. Mm-hmm.
How will this project be funded, Dr. Ennis?
The U.S. so far has been funding the development of the center. However, we would anticipate that additional countries in the region would be contributing to the center down the road by giving resources for staffing, for operations, for programs, etc. A sister organization is being established in Barbados, which will also service the 33 countries, and that should be established within the next few months. And that's
okay.
The Caribbean Tsunami Information Center, which will assist countries in developing their public education programs, conducting training about tsunamis, etc.
Because, you know, hurricane damage has been extremely expensive in the Caribbean. For instance, in Hurricane Allen back in 1980, St. Lucia, that damage was in excess of $615 million. Even in 2004 in Jamaica and Grenada, there was a total of about $1 billion in damage. You have to be applauded, you and your staff and your colleagues have to be applauded that you have now taken these drastic steps to get such a center in place, and I certainly hope that the Caribbean as a whole will unite and realize the severity of this situation and be a part of this exercise.
Thank you. I'm hoping that too. We held a public meeting here last night, and for the first time we had a completely full room, because of course everyone has seen what has happened in Japan. In my view, and in the view of a number of persons across the globe, Japan is the most prepared country on the face of the earth for tsunami.
And look what they're experiencing now.
Exactly. And they have reported $300 billion in damage. Most of the countries of the Caribbean would never recover from that.
Oh, in an event of a tsunami, the entire region could be obliterated.
That's right. That's right. And even a small tsunami, even if you have an event that is much smaller than Japan, and that's the point that I really pushed on last night. If you have just a local tsunami coming into Barbados that may be just 2 meters high, because our economic activity is tourism, and all of the tourist infrastructure is on the coast,
right.
we could still devastate our economy as a result of a very small tsunami.
Just take a look at the Cayman Islands. They are so flat that a tsunami would just absolutely destroy that island.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, before,
and then, of course, the loss of life.
Absolutely, absolutely. Before I let you go, Dr. Ennis, because I know you have a very important event that you have to attend. Since the demise of Prime Minister Thompson, how has Barbados been able to survive that devastating loss?
We are still coping with it, I have to say. Prime Minister Thompson was special in many, many ways. He valued social connections, especially family. And I think many of the individuals in the population bought into his vision and saw where he was going. And so, you know, when he died, it seemed as if the country was cast adrift for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting back together, and you know, we feel as if we now have a new leader who worked with Prime Minister Thompson,
okay.
who appreciated his vision. And we can respect our new leader, and we can also see where he is going. So I think we're now finally coming out of the period of mourning, and we are working now with our new administration to ensure that that vision that the Prime Minister had could be realized in many ways.
Dr. Ennis, if one would like to get in touch with the Tsunami Warning Center, there in Barbados or anywhere in the Caribbean, how can one do that?
I can give you my number. I'm the chair of the Caribbean Tsunami Warning System at the moment.
Is there a website that has been set up?
The website, we have a website for the Caribbean Tsunami Warning Program. Unfortunately, I don't have the address with me.
Okay.
But my email address is linis@coastal.gov.bb, LINNISS. coastal.gov.bb, and my number is 246-228-5950.
Dr. Lorna Ennis, thank you very much for spending this time with us, and we wish you and the Commission and the Center all the best, because it is very critical that things are put in place for any eventuality, because one really never knows when that could happen.
That's right. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, we've been listening to Dr. Lorna Ennis. She's the deputy director of the Coastal Zone Management Unit in Barbados. You're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple.
Hi, I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple.
This isn't over. The pressure's off. You feel it, but you got it all. Believe it when you fold it up. Oh, oh, and if you fold it up, tamina, sangarewa. 'Cause this is Africa. Tamina, mina, waka, waka, tamina, mina, sangarewa. This time for Africa. Shine, don't wait in line, if I must put over. People are raising their Africa. Samina mina, eh eh, waka waka, eh eh. Samina mina, saka lewa, anawa ah ah. Samina mina, eh eh, waka waka, eh eh. Samina mina, saka lewa. It's time for Africa.
I'm well on my journey, biggie biggie mama, one A to Z. My sister, so I'm a journey, biggie biggie mama, from east to west. My team, waka waka, my eh eh, waka waka, my eh eh.
Yes, it's time for Africa. That's Waka Waka by Shakira. Well, we just left Barbados and we're going to take you down the pike, the river pike, that is. We're going to take you over to St. Lucia. And joining us this morning is a journalist, Jerry George. Jerry George, he has a broadcast experience that spans over 30 years. Jerry George, good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Oh, thank you for having me. I look forward to speaking to you.
Absolutely. As usual, you know, we go back a while, back in the days in New York. And
that's a good while back, but we've not lost the connection. I think that's what's important.
You know, and, you know, that is, I'm glad you said that, Jerry, because, you know, we have a tendency, when I say we, I mean human beings. You know, we have a tendency that once a link is broken in that someone has moved physically from a general area, you know, we get caught up with a lot of duties and a lot of stuff that happens around us, and we lose contact. But
unfortunately, especially when it comes to the Caribbean, we're seeing that. So you know, just recently, we've had such a difficulty in traveling to other countries because of the increasing cost of air travel, and that's most unfortunate.
Yes, and not only the cost of air travel, but even within the Caribbean region. That sometimes it is so difficult to even get from one island to the other easily. Yeah, you know, we were just chatting with Dr. Lorna Innes from the Caribbean Tsunami Warning Center, and we were talking about the whole communication and getting other islands informed in a very quick fashion as to the potential of a hurricane and or a tsunami. And we're going to get into a little bit of that. But Jerry, do you feel there is now more need for independent news agencies to have in-depth news from the Caribbean made available to the world?
Indeed. I think you're asking that on the back of the fact that the BBC service, which served the Caribbean for several years,
has been disbanded.
No longer available.
What a shame.
Yes. But, you know, Ron, one of the things I was saying is that, you know, this whole issue about independent news service for the Caribbean goes back a long ways. And you remember there have been some efforts made before in terms of getting Caribbean people together via journalism, the Federation. Remember, there was the CBU, the Caribbean Broadcasting Union.
That's correct.
To have been doing a lot of independent type of documentary radio programs. I remember that we had the CMC at CANA. And just recently, of course, we have had Radio Antilles going off the air as a result of the passage of Hurricane Hugo, which, you know, terribly damaged Montserrat at the time. But I think this is a golden opportunity for us now to say, you know, we have to mature quickly. And mature quickly, not depending on other people to do anything for us, because, you know, nobody will. Everybody is concerned about, you know, their own particular situations. So now we have to start looking and stop sort of lingering on the colonial past, if you wish, and say this is time for bold new movements to towards something that is going to make us or give us the identity we need as a Caribbean people through the media and through great journalism. And I think if you look around the region, whether you are looking at the Bahamas all the way north to, you know, Guyana, South America, in between you will see that we have some great journalists. And I think what has happened is that, you know, politics perhaps sometimes get in the way, but I think that we have had some great examples over the years of people surviving that, and I know that we can do it.
Of course we can. And unfortunately, in mainstream media, when you hear about the Caribbean, it's always in a negative fashion.
Right, yes. Well, that's most unfortunate, but that's why we need to get on board and tell our story. If we have to wait on others to tell the story for us, they will do whatever suits them. And we know that most of the overseas media are usually commercialized, and of course, sensationalism usually plays a great role in terms of the types of stories people want to hear about a region like Caribbean.
Well, sensationalism sells, doesn't it?
It does.
Now, there in your island of St. Lucia, Jerry, has an election date been set for the general election?
Not that I know of. I think that people are looking towards the end of the year.
Okay.
But I think we have until the first quarter of the new year when elections can be held. So anytime from December to March, I think that's where people are sort of setting their sights. But who knows? Politicians always look for the upper hand, and if the party in power realizes that there is any weakness, I would imagine it can call elections any time from now.
How would the new media influence the next election?
Well, we are seeing, let's go back to last election in St. Lucia. I think a great part of it was due to media intervention, the UWP winning, because if you were on the ground at the 2006 general election run, you would see what had happened was that there were predictions that the Labour Party would have won that election. But then came the former Prime Minister, Sir John Compton, out of the blue, or out of the yellow, because that's the parties.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. And we saw that several billboards all around St. Lucia with him looking very statesmanly. And we also, had the people who designed his campaign were saying, you know, here is the man for you. And I think that obliterated whatever gains that the SLP may have made at that particular time. They saw Compton as somebody as credible, somebody who knows what he is about. After all, he had held power for almost something like 31 years. And, you know, he had assisted in the progress and development of St. Lucia, and people wanted that kind of leadership. We already know the unfortunate end as far as Sir John Compton is concerned. But I think, too, a lot of it was played out in the media, and I don't think that any of the parties gave much credence to it. This time around, we're seeing new media, such as, Facebook, and people wanting to do other types of Twitter and such type of media, for example. And what is happening is that I've seen three sites already on Facebook that has been sort of turning people's direction, focus in a different direction. I think what is emerging is that especially people who are educated and people of a certain income who would have easier access to the new media are looking for something more than just, you know, politics as usual. They want politics where, you know, they can exchange ideas. And let me tell you, I was asked to host one of the online discussions by a group called St. Lucians, the People's National Movement for Change in St. Lucia.
Right.
That particular group was saying, well, we are not a political party, but what we do is that we are trying to sort of get discussions going on ideas to change attitudes, lives, and ultimately the existing state of affairs in St. Lucia. Now, I'm reading directly from their Facebook page.
Right, we're hoping to have Mr. Dave Gibson on to really Yeah, we talk much more about that movement there in St. Lucia. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, there's another one called St. Lucians for Change, and again, they are looking at other types of, well, the same thing, the same sort of let's exchange ideas, and the guy who is running this particular one, his website says that he is proposing what is called an independent model or divergent collectivism, the independent model. And he is proposing several things that are different to what we know. For example, he's saying that all candidates in a general election should run on an independent ticket. No parliamentary representative should be made a minister of government. That all ministers be appointed from the public service. Now, these are radical stuff. from what we tend to know about party and parliamentary politics in the Caribbean, and certainly for St. Lucia, but it's generating a lot of discussion, and I think that is what a lot of people are not getting, especially from mainstream media, which has now become basically jukeboxes.
We have absolutely
14 radio stations in St. Lucia, and you would be hard pressed to get a discussion program going about the issues facing us as a country.
You have 14 radio stations in St. Lucia with a population of how many?
The current figure used by the United Nations, 160,000 persons.
160.
Yes.
And you have 14 registered. You mentioned a little earlier, Jerry, the mere fact that maybe some folks of a particular stratus and listening, you know, to the new media. But we also have to remember that it is good for the young people who have this, who are so internet savvy, being given the opportunity of really tuning in to new media.
Yeah, there is another site called Rock the Vote, and I think this is maybe something that has been more or less modified from the United States. But as you can well understand, Rock the Vote is directed mostly at persons below the age of 25.
Right, right.
And they are trying to sort of get people to understand a little more the parliamentary democracy process of, you know, voting, why you need to vote, how you vote, looking at issues, and looking particularly at issues as it concerns young persons below the age of 25. They also have a Facebook page, and there has been some communication back and forth. I think there was an official launch due, or is due, this weekend. I haven't heard much about it recently, mm-hmm. but I think that was the date set. And yet again, it is saying that the young people, if we are to sort of create a country that is different from what we have now, you young people as leaders and as citizens of the future must get involved in the voting process, the election process right now. So, I mean, things that have never happened before, and I think politicians need to take note of this. I know several politicians in St. Lucia on both sides of the political divide do have their own Facebook pages, but these are not very, from my point of view, very active. And it seems that many of them will have to either get people who know about these modern or new media,
mm-hmm.
and also, you know, get them working to their advantage, or they themselves will have to sort of, you know, get up to speed with what they can use the new media for, and particularly to their advantage.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. It's now about 50 minutes after the hour. We're chatting with Jerry George, a journalist out of St. Lucia, and we're talking about the new media and how it would affect not only elections, but life in general. If you'd like to join us in discourse, you can call us within the United States at area code 727-565-1599. You can Skype us. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, U-H-U-R-U Radio, or if you're calling us from across the pond in the United Kingdom, it's 44-020-8133-6629. Jerry, there in St. Lucia, how significant is it that the opposition, the SLP, the St. Lucia Labour Party, has included 4 women among the 17 candidates hoping to regain the government it lost back in 2006?
It is significant because I think a large constituency called women have been ignored for much too long. We have had persons, you know, women on both sides of the House, but not as many, I think, that today's society would like to see. And a lot of people, we only have, as a parliamentary representative, Mrs. Janine Compton Antoine, and she has resigned from the United Workers Party, and I'm not too sure what's going to happen next. Everybody's waiting to see what she will be doing. But certainly her voice is, although she has been very strident and very bold in her pronouncement, but I don't think it is sufficient for the type of society that we want to see a little more equality. So I think that it is a good move by the party, and I do think that we will see something similar happening by the UWP in the upcoming elections as well.
Because of the growing murder rate there in St. Lucia, Prime Minister Stephenson King believes his country can follow Trinidad and Tobago's example in working towards a bipartisan approach to making it easier to carry out hangings. The opposition leader, Kenny Anthony, is not in full agreement.
Well, I myself am not in agreement. I just put that on the table because I have that particular bias.
Okay.
But I must say to you that anything to do with crime cannot be done by either government or opposition alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it can be done even by the church or by any other institution or organization in St. Lucia. We need a multi-sided approach because, as you know, crime is something that we perhaps had not taken very seriously when we had the opportunity to do so in the latter part of the 70s. And so it has mushroomed into something that has now become uncontrollable. And so we need to put our heads together, I think, to come up with workable solutions. Because I think the tendency too often is for us to look outside our countries for the solutions, when in fact these solutions are right here. I have gone on record in saying that one of the things that has proven to be very effective all across the world is that of something called community policing. Mm. In St. Lucia today, we have not had any kind of, how would I say, positive response in terms of community policing. Yes, we've had here and there trials and experiments that just seem to have sort of stopped short of their particular goal, but we have not had any kind of serious engagement. That is, the police has not had any serious engagement with the communities which they purport to be serving. And so how do you go now to a community where you sort of seem to be an invasive force, and then in return ask them for assistance? It just does not add up. And the hanging thing is just a knee-jerk reaction. I have written about that subject, and I said in St. Lucia, the majority of persons see hanging simply as making an example and hoping that example would sort of translate to less crime in St. Lucia. That is madness, you know, because criminals are not as reasoned.
That's right.
You know,
as a regular man in the street. Yes.
No. Sometimes, most of the crime that we've had has been very spontaneous, if you wish, except for perhaps drug trafficking. But the other murder crimes are crimes that are not as very calculating as perhaps, you know, drug trafficking. And so, if you needed to use an example to make crime hanging an effective tool of solving crime in St. Lucia, and I suspect throughout the region, we would have to have a hanging every week to make people believe that the government is very serious about that. Now, the thing is, yes, we will have a hanging, and hanging every week, but preferably, I suppose, most people would prefer in the town square. And that is done once every week, as I said. But this, guess what? We are living in a civil society, and other countries and other parts of the world are looking at this.
Absolutely.
What kind of barbaric behavior we are having?
Yes.
And then we have another headache. You know, I like to describe St. Lucia and most of the islands in the Caribbean as a balloon, a water in balloon economy. You squeeze that water in the balloon, and it appears to disappear, only that it ends up somewhere else.
That's right, just shifts.
Yeah, it just shifts. So, for example, when we had a shift in the focus of our economy from bananas to tourism, a lot of people were displaced, and they turned to drugs. In fact, about 2 or 3 years ago, that was a figure. The information we had was that quite a few persons in Martinican jails came from St. Lucia, and they came from banana-producing areas.
Wow. So what a statistic.
Again, yeah, the thing is, yes, okay, we've moved from bananas to tourism. People are being displaced because no more bananas. They have to look for some way of making money. Some of the younger guys turn to drugs, they end up in Martinique, and they end up being caught and end up in jail. So we are nice and peaceful in St. Lucia because we are focusing on tourism, doing great with that, but at the same time, other things are happening, and again, the water has just shifted to another part of the balloon, and it gives us a sort of seductive notion about solving crime and economic problems.
Since the protests and what has been going on there in North Africa, in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia and Yemen and Syria, the oil and gas prices have been skyrocketing. How are St. Lucians and Caribbean nationals in general coping with the steady increase of oil and gasoline?
Well, there has been discussion. I know that there has been calls here in St. Lucia. In fact, that's the headlines on some of the papers this morning, about whether government could intervene and sort of set a buffer in terms of the increase so it wouldn't affect consumers. But the government's response has been, well, to do that, it would mean that you'd have to be taking money from some other development area, and that doesn't look too good at all. So people are concerned, and it's not anything that is new to us, but we have to find some innovative ways in terms of dealing that with that particular situation. And if it gets any worse in the oil stocking countries, then certainly we are going to feel the squeeze and the pinch. And especially as we're recovering from the economic downturn world over, it is going to be a very tight squeeze for a lot of people. Of course, you know who's going to be squeezed the most.
Absolutely.
So that the lower level,
a small man,
of our economic ladder.
Has it directly been affecting tourism there in St. Lucia?
Not that I know of yet. Not yet. But of course, because we are involved in travel, and tourism depends a lot on airlift, then certainly I think we will have something coming, unless there is a drastic change.
You're listening to Caribbean Forum on the Uhuru Radio Network. I'm Ron Bob Semple, chatting with Jerry George, a journalist who is now one of the lecturers there at Monroe College on the St. Lucian campus. Jerry, in the previous segment, we were chatting with Dr. Lorna Innes, as I mentioned, of the Caribbean Tsunami Warning Unit in Barbados. Now, the World Bank has approved a $15 million U.S. dollar zero-interest credit to help St. Lucia rehabilitate key infrastructure damaged by the passage of Hurricane Tomas in October of 2010.
Right.
Would this give local contractors an opportunity to get in on the bids, or there may be the tendency to import contractors?
I think it would depend on the types of jobs. The recovery efforts so far have been limited mostly to local contractors. And I would imagine if the government is very serious about the rehabilitation effort, it will continue to look at local contractors to do the work. But that is welcome news, though not anywhere close to the types of money that is needed in terms of recovering from Tomas. But certainly it will be a drop in the bucket in terms of relief. And something that I think that a lot of people will find. Because if you look at, if you travel around St. Lucia, you would swear that since October, when Tomas passed, that very little has been done. They have cordoned off, you know, areas that seems to put particularly drivers in danger, but there's not been any further work, I would say, in terms of really serious efforts at reconstruction and rehabilitation.
What is the status of health care in St. Lucia?
We are being squeezed. In fact, I just read a note from a friend, and she has to get, she's traveling from the United States, and while here, she has to get some medical attention, and she was telling me about the amount of money she has to pay for the treatments that she will be undergoing at a local private hospital. And she was asking, well, is there any way that as a St. Lucia national she can get a reduction? And the answer is no. Can she get a discount because she is a returning national? And I think they took off $50 from the cost of her treatment while in St. Lucia. That is one of my, disappointments with the United Workers Party, which forms the present government, because I was part of what is called the UHC, Universal Health Care, which is an experiment by the St. Lucia Labor Party before it was voted out of office. And what has happened is that it was supposed to provide a buffer for St. Lucians seeking health care. I think arrangements have been made with several countries to accommodate certain types of procedures and operations. But locally, what would have happened is there was a basket of conditions which could be provided to St. Lucians at reduced cost as to what it is. So you go to a hospital locally or a health center, and once you present your UHC card, the Universal Healthcare Card, you would be able to get treatment for that without having to incur a great cost. For the part of the 4 years now since the present government has been in power, we've heard nothing about that. The only light at the end of the dark tunnel, as far as healthcare is concerned, is that we are due to open sometime next year a modern medical facility, and which as was first designed by the Chinese government and now being worked out together with the Taiwan government. So that is the only thing that we see. But in terms of healthcare, most of it is in private hands, and you have to pay quite a considerable sum to get some basic healthcare.
Sounds familiar.
It's not good for many people.
Absolutely. What are some of the other social and economic problems, Jerry, that now exist in St. Lucia?
Well, I would say there is need for an overhaul of our education system, because more and more we're seeing that academics is not the only way to go in this competitive environment. We talk a lot about globalism, globalization, and our schools still remain, I in my estimation, in a time warp going back to the 80s. We need to do many more things that are, attractive to today's generation, using some of the new technology that are available. But we are stuck in that time warp of board and chalk, and I think a lot of students are being lost by the wayside as far as that is concerned. In terms of education, too, once one finishes the secondary education, the figure that has been released by the World Bank and supported by organizations like the OECS is that 7% of St. Lucians will go on to higher education.
7%?
13%. 7%. With the high figure of 14 throughout the sub-region, 14% will go on to higher education, meaning university education. And that is dismal, especially when you consider that we are looking to improve the lives of people in St. Lucia. So it means a small number of people will really be reaping the benefits of higher education. So what that means is that a lot of young people are frustrated. A lot of young people may be not having the opportunity or having the chance to channel creativity, innovation, etc. in a direction where it's going to sort of lead them to satisfaction, to negative things, which we can see in such areas such as crime, lethargy, and it's very hard sometimes when you've lost them to motivate them to do anything differently. But can I just mention that one good thing on the education calendar so far is every year we do have the National School Science Fair, and that's coming up next week.
Beautiful.
It's always a very great place to be each year to see the types of experimentation that our students do in secondary and primary school. In fact, one of the experiments maybe about 2 years ago won regional awards, and I think they have international science organizations have been fascinated for it. And the young guy who thought about the experiment, this particular science experiment, has been getting quite a lot of exposure.
Beautiful. Jerry, there appears to be added pressure being felt by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi in Libya to leave and hopefully put an end to the violence that now exists. St. Lucia has close diplomatic relations with the North African country, and Prime Minister King is not in favor of breaking ties with Tripoli. How is the man and the woman in the street there in St. Lucia reacting to your country's ties with the Gaddafi regime?
I think too many people are just too concerned about their day-to-day living. They know it is happening. You know, they know that it is happening, exposure from the news, but it is not something that, oh, my God, if we don't break ties with Libya, you know, it will be the end of the world. No, they're looking at the day-to-day bread-and-butter issues that concern them. And they know that, the oil situation is being affected by it. But other than that, not a large buzz about Tripoli and Libya.
Well, I'm going to get personal with you now, Mr. Jerry George.
Yes.
I know you host a country and Western music program. Is that genre of music popular only in St. Lucia?
Correction, I think there is a guy called DJ Jerry. But this is not the Jerry.
This is not the Jerry. Not the DJ Jerry.
To answer the other part of your question, to settle it, I know there's somewhere on the internet where the radio station that says Jerry George, so somebody may have mixed that up. But I'm not the one hosting the country and Western show.
Yes.
The other part of it is a very popular type of music. There is not a weekend that passes or a holiday that passes when you would not hear country and Western music dances all across St. Lucia.
How did that come about, Jerry?
I think I was just coming to tell you, Ron Bob, that the thing is, it is a type of country and Western music. I don't think you will hear too many hits of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The kinds of music we're hearing in terms of people loving in St. Lucia is music late 40s up to the early 70s. Other than that, modern country, St. Lucians don't care. Before we had our own radio station, people used to tune in on radio, on the AM band, and of course you would get quite a lot of Americans, American stations. And there is this station where DJ Derry plays, actually, which celebrates its 50th year. It started a country and Western show, I think, in the early 70s, and the rest is history. People have fallen in love with that music, and they love the music, as I said, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and the early part of the 70s. That's the kind of country and Western music you would have. There's even a radio station here that plays country and Western music on a Sunday morning, for 5 straight consecutive
I was in Cayman Islands last December, I think it was. And, well, I've been there a couple of times, and standing there in a roti shop, you know, we're listening country a bit, you know, and I had to ask the question, because it's prominent there also in the Cayman Islands.
Indeed, and I can tell you, there is a place called the Country Palace, and you can get country and western music 5 nights a week. With Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night being the explosive nights where country and western fans come out and dance until the early morning hours.
Well, what can I say? Jerry George, Jerry, thank you very much for sharing this this time with us here on Caribbean Forum. I wish you all the best, and looking forward to bringing you back on the air, you know, once things really get into motion, not only with the preparation for the elections there in St. Lucia, but what's happening with you and the whole new media in preparation for the elections.
Yes, fine. Anytime.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Okay.
That was Jerry George. Jerry George, a journalist out of St. Lucia, chatting about the situation there in St. Lucia. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution. Tune in to Africa Live with your host, Yabinga Dzibawe, every Sunday at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. as we discuss issues facing African people around the world, from Brooklyn to Brixton, Cameroon to Caracas, here on WhoRadio.com.
On Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Temple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
Avant que vous t'es parti, t'es promettre moi que vous avez écrit moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, t'es promettre moi que vous avez les moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, vous t'es dit vous avez tout n'avis, moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, t'es dit ou papé, j'en m'éblie, moi. Mes semaines passées, moi passé ou parlez-moi. Ou pas qu'un bébé promesse que vous t'es fait moi. Avant que vous t'es parti. Mes semaines passées, moi passé ou parlez-moi. Pas qu'un bébé promesse que vous t'es fait moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, c'est pas ça on t'es dit. Avant que vous t'es parti, ou t'es dit ou papé j'en m'éblie, moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, ou t'es dit ou papé vini chez moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, t'es promettre quoi pé toujours les moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, ou t'es dit quoi pé tout la vie, ouais moi.
téléphone sonne et qu'aimerait pas sauter.
This is Felicia.
Ou pas jamais écrit.
Hey Ron.
Relais-moi. C'est chaque jour où me lever. Ma bête en la poste passée. Ou téléphone sonne et qu'aimerait pas sauter. Ou pas jamais écrit. C'est pas ça, on t'a dit. Ou pas elle ni ou pas écrit.
I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple.
Tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
I kind of slept in later.
Listen, I'm gonna. I'll give you some time. I've got to.
No. Oh, you have something to show?
Yes, I've got a few seconds.
Oh, I'm not ready if you
want
to do it.
Pardon me?
I'm ready.
Oh, you're ready? Okay. Yes, it's about 20 minutes.
My shattered dreams, yes, and broken heart, I'm mending on the shelf. I saw you. Holding hands, standing close to someone else. Still I sit all alone, wishing all my feelings were. I give my best to you. Nothing for me to do. But I've one last cry.
Well, there are many cries all over the world. The violence, the protests, the bad weather. And we've been chatting earlier this morning with Dr. Lorna Innes out of Barbados from the Caribbean Tsunami Warning Center. And then we went over to St. Lucia chatting with Jerry George, journalist Jerry George, as St. Lucia is preparing for its elections later on this year or early next year. And now we're going to turn to New York, and we're going to chat with Felicia Passage. She is the CEO of Heartbeat News, which is now responsible for News Americas. Felicia, as usual, good morning, and welcome again to Caribbean Forum.
Good morning, Ron.
Sorry, good morning, Ron. I wish I was there with the weather that you guys are having. We're having very cold weather in April, even tonight.
Isn't this unbelievable? I remember back in 1977 that there were about 11 inches of snow in New York in April. The flowers didn't.
Oh,
the flowers did not know what to do.
Oh, wow. Well, at least we're lucky. We're not 11 inches.
So. But still, New York has been really hit this winter season. And boy, I don't know. Well, not only New York. The weather's just been crazy all over the world.
Well, it is obviously a global warming, so we'll see what happens with that. People need to take it very seriously.
Well, a lot of people felt that it was just a joke, a facade. Anyhow, we're gonna jump right into what's happening in the news, not only in the Caribbean but the entire diaspora. Felicia, on March 20th, there was an election runoff in Haiti between Compas singer Michel Martelly and former First Lady Marilyn Manigat. Now, we should have received the final results last Thursday, but that has been delayed for a few days. What's the latest you've heard?
Well, actually, it was the preliminary results were due on Thursday, the 31st of March.
Okay.
And then the Provisional Council came out with a notice on, I think it was Tuesday, that said that could not happen anymore because what they had discovered is a lot of fraud within the votes that they're counting. So that is their claim, and now they're saying that that election, the preliminary results, is going to come on Monday of the new week, and the final results will be justified on April 16th. So hopefully by then, once the final results become justified, that's when Haiti will see a new president.
Speaking of president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's return seems to have been downplayed.
Well, I think Jean Bertrand has been probably warned not to say anything.
Warned by whom?
Well, we're not hearing anything from him because he absolutely said nothing regarding the election. He said nothing since, I think, maybe like Duvalier. He just went home to sort of relax and not do anything else.
But
and
he was warned by whom, Felicia? He was warned by whom?
If President Obama can get on the phone to the South African president and tell him he didn't think that René Préval should be back in Haiti, then I'm sure that, you know, we can kind of figure from there where the warning is coming from.
I'm sorry, I'm just enjoying this. Felicia, your lead story in the News Americas this week is the apparent decline of green card holders from Latin America and the Caribbean. Just tell us a little more about that.
That is a very interesting scenario, and we're seeing that for U.S. citizens, too, from last year. I think what is going on is that a lot of the immigration system that we're seeing is getting very, very tighter, and obviously the green card processing is taking a lot longer to do, especially as regards sibling sponsorship and parent sponsorship. So what we're seeing is really a very, very harsh tightening of the immigration system, and interestingly, under a Democratic administration. Now, that leads me to the whole other issue of the deportation, which is also rising tremendously under the Obama administration. And it's very interesting that the president this week told the Latino community in a town hall meeting that he has no control over that, and there was no way that he could actually pass an executive order or write an executive order that says that young people who are among the deportees, the young students who are here illegally, that he could not do absolutely anything for them until the Congress acted. I just think that is complete nonsense, and the president has executive power. He's used it before, and he definitely can use it if he really wants to do something for immigration.
Speaking of immigration, a decade ago, dozens of Caribbean teachers were recruited from their homelands to work in the New York City's Department of Education. Now they're being threatened with deportation?
Yeah, that's the other story, Ron. And, you know, let me just justify this, because especially for American listeners who listen to your program, the American public often goes away with the assumption that undocumented immigrants are simply coming over the border or coming into this country and just simply overstaying their visas and breaking the law. And here is a situation that we've always said that this is not always true of undocumented immigrants. These teachers were recruited. They were brought to this country to educate the public system in New York City, public school students in the system, which the city at the time had a very, very bad rap. These teachers came into a very harsh system. They were promised that they would be given legalization, a green card eventually. They've done everything that they can, and up to now they're being punished, basically in limbo they're living. A lot of them could face deportation because they have yet to get their green card, and the work visas that they're being given are continually expiring. They have to wait forever. So they're at the whim of the system, especially now when the city's mayor is talking about he's going to be cutting teachers and cutting jobs in the city. These teachers are the most vulnerable right now. And once they're fired, obviously that makes them an undocumented immigrant. That leaves them vulnerable to everything. Their children are considered largely undocumented. They can't work. They can't do anything. Their spouses, too, can't work, can't do anything. So a family is basically dependent on the one person. It's such a nightmare, Ron. And these teachers are excellent teachers. They have master's degrees. They have PhDs. The best of the best from the Caribbean were taken and brought here, and now they're being treated like they're second-class citizens. In fact, they're being tagged as unskilled professionals in the application that's before the New York State Labor Department, which is also very, very disconcerting to everyone, considering the way that other folks who were brought from European countries are being treated.
When these teachers were hired, they were given a special immigration status. What's the difference between an EB2 and EB3 classification?
Well, EB2 and 3 are basically for, like, they're just a work visa. They were given that work visa initially and brought here into the country. Then they were given a J visa, which allowed them to teach for 3 years with the option to renew. But ultimately, you can't keep renewing the work visas. You have to have a green card at the end of the day that the employer has to have a sponsorship application in that fast-tracks that. Now, this is the city we're talking about. They can fast-track it if they'd like to do that. I just don't think that they really are that concerned about these teachers because they feel, look, we have them here. They already are doing the job. Why not just keep them, you know, where they are? And I think that really is the attitude. And on top of it, there is no one really lobbying for the teachers. Now there is the former ACORN head, Bertia Lewis, has taken up the issue. But I still haven't heard anything. I'm not hearing anything from our politicians. I'm not hearing anything from Congresswoman Yvette Clark or anybody getting involved on behalf of these teachers who are just in limbo. There are so many horror stories that they're going through. One teacher, her husband actually could not deal with the whole stress and emotional breakdown from the system. He had an emotional breakdown. He actually killed the teacher, his wife, and their kids. And so this is the sort of effect that it's having on families. There's another teacher whose husband died, and because actually her husband was the teacher and she was the spouse, now that the husband has died, the system is telling her that she no longer qualifies to have a green card or live legally in this country. So she's basically been thrown out and become undocumented. And this is the sort of horror stories we're hearing from people who were brought here of their own, obviously it was of their own free will, but they were enticed here. They were given, told all these great things that were going to happen. They were going to get given housing. They were going to be given a chance to get the New York City certification, to have a master's degree. They've done all these things. Some of these teachers already had master's degrees, and now they're being basically treated as unskilled employees.
A few months ago, there was a threat of Mayor Bloomberg closing several schools. I think it was the 30th district. What is the latest in that?
Well, they're still saying that they're going to go ahead because of the budget shortfalls. And that is really another concern of the teachers, because this means if these teachers are in these schools and
they are fired under that proposal by the mayor, that makes them completely illegal to be here, and they cannot basically go on with the process for legalization. So the Department of Labor would basically throw out the application, and that is what they're most afraid of. Of course, this proposal affects many other teachers who are here, not just from the Caribbean, but who are here from this city. And that is something, I think, that concerns everyone. Even the governor's budget proposal concerns everyone, because how could you be cutting education and services that are so needed and thinking that that is going to be okay and that is going to spur growth when you also are talking about cutting taxes at the same time, but you're taking out the social services that are so important?
What percentage of the internationally recruited teachers are from the Caribbean?
That is really the number that nobody really knows for sure, because a lot of the teachers are just like all over the place. They're not really coming forward. But what we do know is that in 2001, 500 Caribbean-born teachers were recruited from several countries, including Jamaica, and they are here. Some of them have gotten green cards. Others have not over the past 6 years. So I would say about 20% of the number of international recruits. That's what the number registers. Green card holders from that number are 276 from the Caribbean. So about 276 of those recruited so far have gotten their green cards, but others are living in basic limbo.
So you really don't know the percentage of those who have received permanent residency status?
They don't, and because of the fact that a lot of the teachers, they never really got together as a group. They're only now doing this based on Bertia Lewis's call. So they're trying to get themselves organized and get themselves together as a group to lobby and fight against this. And so that is why they don't really know for sure, because many went off on their own once they got here, and I guess they're dealing with the burdens of this alone.
In the last couple of minutes, Felicia, what's a hot-button item in the news?
Well, I definitely want to touch on the Ponzi schemer from Jamaica. And also, Ron, I don't know if you missed that whole finger rape claim coming out of Jamaica. That was a big story. It still is a big story from last week. But let me just talk a little bit about the Jamaican Ponzi schemer. David Smith, he's actually was the head of Olin. Many people may remember Olin. It suddenly popped up in Jamaica as a major investment organ, and it was throwing money everywhere, and people were going all crazy. And now suddenly this guy has admitted that it was a Ponzi scheme. In fact, it was a giant Ponzi scheme that he was running there, and now he pleaded guilty, he's copped the plea, and he's facing sentencing in June. So it's a very interesting case, because I remember he was flying in very important folks on his jet. The politicians of the day were very happy with him, and so it's a very, very similar case, I think, the fall, like we've seen with Alan Sanford.
Right, I'm just about saying there's a possibility that he may be in the same institution with Alan Sanford.
He's actually in Florida, so I think he's going to be serving his time out in Florida, because I believe the way the federal government could have gotten him was only through Florida, because he had property there, and he also had clients in Florida, Jamaican clients there. And that was the way the feds were able to actually arrest him and extradite him from the Turks and Caicos, because he was also there in the Turks and Caicos. He was in jail for a bit there in the Turks and Caicos, because they had also found him guilty of a similar charge.
Well, Felicia, thank you very much, as usual. And we'll be looking forward to chatting with you and hearing your reports on News Americas.
Thank you so much, Ron. Always a pleasure.
Welcome. Have a good weekend.
Yes,
that was Felicia Fassad, the CEO of Heartbeat News, now responsible for News Americas. Well, this weekend would be the 43rd anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Here is Dr. Martin Luther King
talking about his displeasure about the war in Vietnam.
The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. Now, I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty. Against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom, there has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silent. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. And so this morning I speak to you on this issue, because I'm determined to take the gospel seriously. There is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. And you may not know it, my friends, but it is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. And so I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery, and I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed, and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement. We nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Bull Connor." There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward Jim Clark," but will curse and damn you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children." There's something wrong with that press. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. And this is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cries. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told. And all the while, the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. This is a role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investment. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say, this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, a sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And it is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. And our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. A genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This calls for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation, is in reality a call for an all-embracing, unconditional love for all men. This often misunderstood and misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly force, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of mankind. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against this war, not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away, and this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. Now, it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated. When you tell the truth and take a stand, sometimes it means losing a job. It means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7 or 8 year old child asking your daddy, why do you have to go to jail so much? But I've long since learned that to be a follower of Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown we wear, there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it. Bear it for truth. Bear it for justice. Let us go out this morning with that determination. And I have not lost faith. I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to beat up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. With this faith, we'll sing it as we are getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
April 3rd, 1968 was a very dark day in our history, the day that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. I'd like to thank Dr. Lorna Innes, Jerry George, and Felicia Cassatt, my guests this morning here on Caribbean 4. But I can't seem to find my way. Watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. Watch your character, for it becomes your destiny. We'll see you tomorrow at 7 p.m. with Golden Sunday Sounds. I'm Ron Bob Semple. Have a good evening. Because of my pride, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. It's such a drag to be on your own.